New information tonight about the spot where Gabby Petito's remains were found, including how authorities knew where to look. Plus, were Brian Laundrie's parents accessories after the fact? And just what charges could they still face? And the armorer says it's the producer's fault that a cinematographer was killed on that movie set. Is she blaming Alec Baldwin, the actor, but also the producer? Plus, Kiss of Death. The roadies blame the band, and the band blames the roadies. So who is responsible for the COVID death on tour of a beloved KISS crew member? On Banfield. Welcome to Banfield on this Friday night. We have new details tonight in the Brian Laundrie investigation, specifically what played out after Gabby Petito was killed and how those events and details might impact charges being levied against what seems to be the only people left to charge in the case, Brian's parents, Chris and Roberta Laundrie. In the last hour on ABC's 2020, we learned that the YouTuber known as Red, White and Bethune, who spotted the white van in Grand Teton, actually notified the authorities. Jen Bethune spoke with ABC, and it is believed that her information directly helped police to locate Gabby's remains. Here is Ms. Bethune describing the moment that she realized she had captured the location of Gabby's van on her dash cam.
I had got tagged on a story on Instagram by someone saying that the police timeline has changed. And if you were in the campground, please check your footage, check pictures, check anything you have. When we found the footage, I'm like, please, please keep recording. Please keep recording. Please be on here. And my husband Kyle's standing next to me. And all of a sudden, we see this white speck getting closer and closer and closer. And we both got goosebumps all over our body. We knew it was her van as soon as the footage passed by it.
Gabby's remains were eventually located, and they were less than 1,000 feet from where that van was parked. Yesterday, our Brian Enten was there, and he shared video that he took while visiting that site in Grand Teton. And you can see the large cross made out of rocks that Gabby's stepfather built. It is still there, but several visitors have come to pay their respects, and they've left these mementos behind. Brian Enten also found several messages of remembrance that were left around the site, and he sent some photos. We can share them with you tonight, and so we can look a little closer. One says, Gabby, always. And another one says, may your love live on forever in our hearts. And that one looked to be on a little bag left behind. And then there are two in this photo. The pink one in the middle says, let it be, with her emblem, like her design of her tattoo. Also says, the world didn't know you, but now the world loves you. Then you can obviously read R.I.P. Gabby. The one on the right there is from one who traveled to the site from Kentwood, Louisiana. The case has really touched so many people across the country, as well as all around the world. And it feels like all of them seem to want to know the same thing. Is there going to be justice for Gabby Petito? Because so far, it doesn't feel like it. I'm joined by Chris Swecker, the former assistant director of the FBI Criminal Investigations Unit. He led the search for the Olympic Park bomber, Eric Rudolph. And Chris, you know, it is a fair question to ask. You know, the only suspect that we know of at this point, not officially, because the FBI is not talking, is dead. Brian Laundrie, he's dead. But a lot of people wonder about the behavior of the parents. And overall, is that a fair question to wonder about their behavior?
Well, given their behavior, yes. I mean, there are a number of federal statutes that may apply here, and I was looking at a couple of them earlier in the day. There's potentially harboring a fugitive. If you give any kind of aid or take in a federal fugitive and hide them or give them the means to escape, That's a 3-year felony. Misprision of a felony, knowing that a felony has taken place and not reporting it, is a 3-year federal statute. And accessory after the fact is potentially half the sentence of the federal homicide statute. So that could be as much as 20, 25 years.
Well, that's a big one. So let me drill down on that one, because, I mean, that's very, very serious, not to suggest the other ones aren't. But accessory after the fact is more intriguing to me only because the harboring part, by the time he was charged with bank fraud, Brian was gone. So unless they were sneaking sandwiches or money or something to him, which we can go into later as to how they could find that evidence, that would be a hard one. But here's the one that I really like in the accessory after the fact code. It means someone who assists, and I'm going to read them off, someone who assists somebody who's committed a crime, someone who assists after the person has committed a crime, someone who assists with knowledge that the person committed a crime, and someone who assists with the intent to help the person avoid arrest or punishment. And I am curious about that particular one, because all of those things could have happened. And bear with me while I kind of break it down here, Chris Swecker. If the crime was committed on the timeline that we think, which is the 27th of August, then there's the 27th, 28th, 29th, 30th, but then there's all that time until September 11th, 13th, actually. Let me take you to the 13th, because that's the timeline that has Brian Laundry leaving on his walk. So there's the 27th to the 13th, in which those two people could have helped Brian make his way from Grand Teton, where the scene of the crime was discovered, the remains of Gabby. They could have helped wire him money along the way. I'm not saying they did, but these are all things that could have happened in that time. They could have given him guidance on mapping. They could have told him when the coast was clear how to get there to the house when there's no media or police. Then when they were there, they could have gone on that camping trip. They could have given him guidance on what to do during that camping trip. And they could have taken money out. They could have helped him. They could have given him all sorts of things to send him on his way. So with that timeline in place, is it so far flung to think that accessory might just be what the FBI is looking at?
Yeah, actually, I'm back on. So, no, it's not a stretch. I don't think it's a stretch at all. You first have to prove that there was a homicide. It was committed by a principal, and that would have been Brian Laundry. I mean, given his behavior, given all of the evidence, there's so much evidence out there. He drives home in her van. He's using her debit card. He doesn't report her missing for 10 days. She was recovered in an area where his van was spotted within 1,000 feet. Plus all the other evidence they've gathered, forensic evidence and electronic evidence, communication evidence, et cetera. So I don't think there's any issue as to whether he could have been convicted of homicide. So once there is a principal and there's a crime of homicide, then you prove that someone helped them in some fashion. And you just listed all
the
different
Chris?
Things.
Yeah, but now that you said that, I'm rethinking this. So you can't charge a dead man. You can't try a dead man. You can't convict a dead man. So technically, we can't actually establish this as a murder. So now how do all these things on the screen fit in? You know, you have to have assisted someone who committed a crime after the person committed the crime, with knowledge that the person committed a crime, with the intent to help the person avoid arrest or punishment. But we don't have that crime now. How do we, is this possible now?
Well, I think the way the law sets up is that you prove the crime was committed by that person, and then you prove that someone assisted them or conducted the actions that fit the statute. I don't think you have to have an actual underlying conviction in a court of law.
Oh.
I think you prove the elements of the homicide and that he did it, and then you bring out all the elements of accessory after the fact, and you prove those elements.
Hope for the people who really want something to happen. They're not looking at this and saying, well, that's out the window, considering we can't get a conviction here. It's interesting, that part of the law. Do you have to have all four of them, Chris Weckert, in order to actually get an accessory?
No, I don't think you have to have those four elements. I think it's any one of them. So if they provided some sort of assistance financially, a burner phone, knowing that he, or having sufficient information that he committed the homicide or committed the underlying crime, if they helped him get away when they took him to the campground, I mean, my personal theory is, or I wonder if that wasn't just a way to consolidate out, away from the eyes of prying neighbors and others, to put the game plan together, gather up supplies without anybody watching them, and then this launch from there, whatever he was going to do. I think it was just a way to get away from the house and
yeah, I'm really glad you said that. Yep, I'm glad you said that, because what a smart thing to do, right? Go somewhere where there's no microphones or Alexas or phones or anything else, and then if you need to have a conversation, have it at your tent site. But it does bring to light all the things that the FBI does have in its toolkit, and it's not just, you know, the phones or the bugs in the house or that sort of thing. It's also your Apple Watch, right? It's also your online banking. So if you took out a bunch of cash, right, the FBI could say, where is the money? Show us the notes. And if you spent it, show us where you spent it. And if you gave it away, take us to the people you gave it to. I mean, you can. There are ways you can track big, you know, sure, buckets of money. But also, there's GPS, right? So you can have GPS on cars. There's the right hard drives if you did any research about what you're going to talk about at the campsite. Your cell phone is still showing where you ping and what you do. And your Apple Watch will tell you a few things as well. But do you think, Chris Walker, with all your background with the FBI, that if there was a plan forged in that campsite where they went for the weekend, that they could ever get any evidence of what was discussed and actually have some evidence of some sort of accessory after the fact?
Probably not. Unless, you know, there's still that notebook sitting out there, and you just wonder if that wasn't a diary that that Brian held, you know, that put together. I'm interested in knowing what was in that notebook. Maybe the only people that were privy to that conversation were those three, theoretically. Maybe he wrote about it. That's the only way, unless one of the two parents comes out and talks about it. And that's not going to happen. There's a marital privilege.
So, Chris, they said, well, of course, the marital privilege, that's stymieing a lot of that effort to get information from Chris and Roberta. But like you said, that notebook, this is day 8, Chris Wecker. It was found and it was wet, and they said they needed to dry it before they even cracked it open. But then they did say it was salvageable. But on day 8... again, your experience in the FBI, will they have already had a thorough look at the contents of what Brian Laundrie wrote?
I would say yes. I mean, that's not my area of expertise, but I think it's forensically. I think they have had plenty of time to use heat and other means of drying it out. You know, I don't know how well it was protected in the backpack. I have another theory, and it's pure speculation. If he killed himself, he did it on land, and only his remains were found in the water, and that's probably happened by wildlife. So I believe that there, all these other things were on dry land. If he used a weapon, that would have been on dry land. No animal's going to pick that up and take it away. I think that the backpack was found on dry land. It might have been wet from the rain, but I don't think it was laying in water. Again, I wasn't at the scene. I'm speculating, but I think I think the chances are very good that he did not, if he killed himself, he did not do it in the water, that he was pulled into, dragged into the water by.
But it's all close. The backpack and the dry bag, and then the notebook was found outside the dry bag, and the remains, they were all found pretty close, which makes me think that animals didn't pull those remains too far away from, you know, Brian's things, where he ultimately ended up dying. Okay, real quickly, I got to ask you, social media, at this point, we're starting to learn like the power and the strength of social media when it comes to policing. It used to be that, you know, people might have been a nuisance, but now they're kind of essential. And I'm hearing all over the country, Chris Wecker, they are opening up social media divisions within law enforcement because it is just so helpful. And I think this case proves it, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I know of another case that I'm personally, as an attorney, working on, that where social media basically solved the case and provided information for a search warrant that found a body. So social media is a powerful thing. If it's channeled properly, I think it can be very effective. So yeah, police detectives and agents need to know how to effectively use social media. And I hate to have private entities do their work for them, but in this case, that's exactly what happened.
Did it ever. Chris Wecker, great to have you. Thank you for your expertise and have a relaxing weekend. We do appreciate having you on.
Thank you.
Straight ahead. She's been portrayed as inexperienced, irresponsible, and in way over her head. Now Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, the woman in charge of the guns on Rust, wants to set the record straight. Her side of the deadly shooting is next. And beloved by the KISS Army, a longtime member of the Rogue Crew has died from COVID, and the blame game has begun. The accusations are flying of fake vaccination cards and lax protocols, but who is telling the truth? It's next. So much is fake in the movie business, but the armorer's job is as real as anything gets. And the armorer on Alec Baldwin's film is Hannah Gutierrez-Reed. You may have heard that she's just 24 years old and that her father, a man named Fel Reed, is a legend among movie armorers. You may not have heard that she's speaking out for the first time today and saying that the blame for what happened on the set of Rust falls squarely somewhere else, namely the producers. Through her lawyers, she released a statement, and I want to break it down with some help of some very smart and experienced people. Stu Brumbaugh is a Hollywood veteran. He's the key grip from Hannah's first and only movie before Rust. And Randy Zellin is a criminal defense attorney, a former prosecutor, and an adjunct professor at the Cornell Law School. Gentlemen, welcome to both of you. Thank you for joining me. I just want to mention that Hannah expressed condolences right off the bat. And her lawyers declared that she is, quote, devastated at what happened. And I want to go on and read a little bit more from what she says in, her lawyers say in the statement. Hannah has no idea where the live rounds came from. Hannah and the prop master gained control over the guns, and she never witnessed anyone shoot live rounds with these guns, and nor would she permit that. They were locked up every night and at lunch, and there's no way a single one of them was unaccounted for or being shot by crew members. Hannah still to this day has never had an accidental discharge. The first one on this set was the prop master, and the second was a stuntman after Hannah informed him his gun was hot with blanks. So, Stu, let me just ask you off the bat. It's just hard for a layperson like me who doesn't spend time on a film set like you to not feel as though She's deflecting the blame onto other people there, which is just as unfair as maybe putting all the blame on her. How do you feel about that?
Well, working with Hannah, and I've kind of said this from the onset, everybody's looking for a villain. Everybody wants these sound bites about what happened on our film and applying it towards the film Rust. Hannah is, she's 24 years old. She's inexperienced. We all are aware of this. We had some unannounced discharges on our set. Were they misfires or whatever, or not necessarily misfires, but just shots that rang out for no reason? I think they were motivated by something, but they were not announced. So the protocol was certainly broken. I wasn't on the movie Rust. I can't say what happened. I don't know who was in charge of the firearms at that point, where those firearms were sitting, how the AD gained access to them. But I will say that there is never ever in our industry a reason to have fully functioning live ammunition on a movie set ever. In my 20 plus years in this industry, there's never been a need for it. So as far as her placing the blame, you know, I think there is a more than one person that's culpable here. You know, I've tried to come forward and say, look, you know, in this industry, we're working with these shoestring budgets over the last few years, and all of our departments are being hamstrung. We're working more hours. We're with less crew, and it creates these dangerous environments. And you know, in this particular situation, you know, we kind of saw this building up, and it wasn't. And it may not have been with Hannah. It may not have been in a Western. It may not have, you know, been necessarily a feature film, but the recipe has been there. It wasn't a matter of if it happened. It was a matter of when it happened. I can understand where Hannah's coming from, because she really was overwhelmed on this movie from what I'm understanding.
Well, and you know, you're not wrong. Let me just read a little bit about what Hannah says about, you know, being hired. Hannah was hired on two positions on this film, which made it extremely difficult to focus on her job as an armorer. She fought for training days to maintain weapons and proper time to prepare for gunfire, but ultimately was overruled by production and her department. The whole production set became unsafe due to various factors, including lack of safety meetings. This was not the fault of Hannah. So, Randy Zellin, as a lawyer, I suppose you see this differently. I get what Stu is saying, but culpability by law is culpability by law. I can see that she's saying the producers, a.k.a. Alec Baldwin and the other producers on the set, are more culpable than she, but that's not the way the sheriff and the DA look at it, is it?
Well, certainly the first piece of advice I would give her and her lawyers is shut your mouth. You can only talk yourself into trouble. I think the point is here, there's a legal issue and a practical issue. As a practical matter, and having been a gun owner, you don't hand a gun to someone without checking it. If you think that there are no bullets in the chamber, you check it before you hand the gun over. And it's very easily done with a semi-automatic weapon. So that's point number one. Point number two is, if you're under too much pressure, if you can't do your job properly, the same way I explained to my students today in class, if you have an unreasonable client, you quit. If the client's making you do something that you don't want to do, you quit. As an armorer, if you can't get things done, if you can't protect the people that you are entrusted to protect, you quit. Because if you don't, this is what happened. Now, from a purely legal standpoint, we have to distinguish between different forms of liability. There's negligence. Negligence is you put your head down and you don't realize that the light changed from green to red. Reckless is, you know that the light changed, you don't mean to hit anyone, but you're going through the light anyway. Intentional is, you go through that light because you want to hit someone. So there are a few crimes that call for negligent conduct, meaning I didn't realize that what was going to happen, but in New Mexico, there happens to be culpable negligence in a homicide situation. Do I think anyone will be charged criminally? No. Do I think anyone should be charged criminally? No. Civilly, there is going to be hell to pay, but again, if I am the armorer on this set, shut your mouth.
You know, it's interesting. You look at it almost like an airline pilot. You know, the company, the airline wants you to leave on time, and you're the pilot, and you can tell the company to, you know, bug off. My plane, I'm not happy with it, and I don't like what's going on. And if you don't, you know, the pilot gets in trouble. Stu Brumbaugh, thank you again. Really appreciate you taking that time. And Randy, you're going to stick around because I've got another story that I need your legal expertise on. Do appreciate that. This question, though, you know, who put the real bullet into a gun that was supposed to have blanks? That is the key question here, for the investigators at least in the Santa Fe, who are right now sorting through that deadly movie disaster. So big question, have they dusted the gun for prints? Somebody handled it. Maybe someone else. The forensic trail is next. Plus, are these the faces of a guilty party? Some KISS roadies are pointing fingers at the faces of the operation, saying COVID killed one of their own and safety lapses were to blame. But the band has a couple of complaints of its own. Yeah, Battle of the Band is next. Welcome back. 8 days after two people were shot on a movie set and one of them died, we have seen heartbreak and outrage, blame and denials, even an admission from the film's assistant director that he should have checked the fateful gun more carefully. But none of that tells us who put the live round into the gun that should have had, at the very most, blanks. Finding out requires the type of real-world police work that movies so love to dramatize. The type of work done by my next guests, Bill Cannon. He's a former homicide detective, 27-year veteran of the NYPD. Mike Chitwood is the sheriff of Volusia County, Florida. Gentlemen, thank you. It's great to have both of you. Bill, I'm going to begin with you. That is the question everybody wants to know the answer to. Who put a real cartridge with a real bullet instead of a blank cartridge with no bullet into a prop gun? How hard will it be to prove that?
Well, the first thing they should have done was totally lock down that crime scene and not let anyone of the, I believe there were 16 people inside that church. No one leaves. You have to separate them. That sounds easy to do, but it's not so easy to do. You have to separate everyone and do in-depth interviews. The interviews should be finished that day. They should never be calling someone back, because once someone leaves and seeks counsel or talks to someone else, you're never going to get the truth out of them. You have to get the truth that night. And, you know, you have to use investigative techniques that detectives learn over a long career. And they vet the information against the other witnesses. And when one, that's why you don't let anyone leave. You keep talking to them till you get the truth. Because once someone leaves, you're never going to get the truth.
You know, you can see the set there. The church is in the middle of a pretty vast area. And Mike Chitwood, you're a sheriff. Like, let's say this is your scene. You got 90 to 100 people who are spread out all over that area. A finite number in the church. We think somewhere around a baker's dozen or so. I asked the sheriff there, did you do any handbagging and gunshot residue testing of anybody else but Alec? And he said no. And all I could think was, whoever might have been out there messing around with the guns beforehand and using real ammo might just have GSR on his or her hands. But now we won't know that. Is there another way that you can think of, like maybe the fingerprints on the gun or fingerprints on the casing? But then you got to match the casing to the lead that was found in the director's shoulder. Can it be done?
Ashley, first let me tell you, everything Bill said is 1,001% on. Gunshot residue testing really is inadmissible in court. For me, first of all, what Bill said, lock down a scene, interview everybody, that's what you have to do. Number two, what is the training and expertise of our quote-unquote armorer? Were there drugs or alcohol on the scene? Was the weapon community used off-premises firing these live rounds? Are there spent casings? It's a revolver, so they had to dump it out. Why were those live rounds there? And how about everybody's text messages, cell phone video? What were they doing off scene? Surely they were picturing themselves on back and forth. And then, of course, you would DNA and fingerprint the box of bullets. But I also want to tell you, this stuff being floated around about a prop gun, that's BS. Because we in law enforcement, when we train, we have quote-unquote prop guns. They're inert weapons. They cannot fire a live round. They can fire a blank round, or they can fire a simulated round, which strikes, you know, it's like a paintball round. So the fact that you have a quote-unquote live round, live ammunition, tells me that along the line of this filming, that was a community gun. Everybody was playing around with it, and there's hell to pay for this.
Well, I'll tell you what, to that end, and you're right, there are real things used on movie sets all the time. They just call them props, but they are definitely real. Real cell phones, real guns, but they are props on the set. Doesn't mean they're fake. So you're right there, Mike Chitwood. I want you to listen to this quick interview I had, a piece of it, with the sheriff in Santa Fe. And it was about Hannah's pockets, because I was fascinated to find out what might be in the pockets of the armorer when she came in to talk to the sheriff. So listen to this, and we'll talk on the other side. Were Hannah's pockets, and I've only got a couple seconds left, were Hannah's pockets checked for live bullets?
Hannah's pockets were checked, and I'm not willing to confirm whether or not there were live bullets that were found on her person.
Hey, Bill Cannon, that question for me would have been an easy no, unless they found something in Hannah's pockets. So what did that say to you?
I think they probably did find something in her pocket, you know, and that's why, you know, these interviews, you lock them down and you get them to tell the truth. Then you only get one shot in an interview. And I just like to make one point. You were talking about fingerprinting guns. The surfaces of guns, you know, TV all the time teaches people that you can get fingerprints off guns. The NYPD has less than a 2% hit ratio of lifting fingerprints off of guns, and there's two reasons. One of them is the surface. The second one is that fingerprints are made from the oils of your skin. So when a gun is fired, it gets very hot, and it dissipates the oil, and that destroys the fingerprint. So that's sort of a misnomer that you're going to lift fingerprints. There's a better chance of lifting DNA.
Interesting. I would think maybe off the handle it wouldn't get as hot, but it's really, I hadn't thought of that.
The handle's a surface, goodness, that's not amenable. It's not amenable to lifting, yeah, prints, the handle.
Really, really fascinating. Gosh, I could spend hours and months and days and weeks and all the rest talking to you guys about this. It's the whole forensics thing. Bill Cannon, Sheriff Mike Chitwood, thank you. Happy Friday to you. Have a good Halloween weekend.
Thank you, Ashley.
Thank you.
Always good to talk to them. All right. I don't know if you saw this, but the KISS cruise left the port of Miami today. What a sight. Oh, what a sight that is. The ship set sail less than 2 weeks, however, after Paul Stanley's beloved guitar tech died of COVID, and the roadies are angry at the band. Now the KISS Navy has piled onto a ship. Is it possible anything could go wrong? I'm talk about this next. It is an army, it is a movement, and for some it is a lifestyle. You can call it what you want, but KISS fans call it rock and roll, and they want to do it all night and every day. And I am right there with them. Are you kidding me? This is like some of my favorite stuff. It takes me back. Here's the problem. In the age of COVID, it is tough to rock and roll all night and party every day safely. And the KISS concert tour has really found that out the hard way. Franz Stuber, who for more than 20 years has been the guitar technician for KISS frontman Paul Stanley, he died of COVID back on October 17th. He's a really skilled guy. He can play every one of those instruments. He handles all the guitars, tunes them, knows everything about them. But he got COVID and he died. And now there is a war that is brewing between the roadies and the band as to who is to blame for his death. The roadies are claiming that the COVID protocols on the tour were lax and that those who got the virus were just dumped in hotels and left there. Mr. Stuber died in a hotel room just 2 days after quarantining in Detroit. Paul Stanley tweeted his love and his respect for his friend, Mr. Stuber. But the band effectively is really singing a different tune on this one. They're saying that some of the members of the road crew were not following the rules. And there were a lot of rules, they said. Back now, criminal defense attorney Randy Zellin, and also joining us is entertainment attorney Dominic Romano, who is the managing partner of Romano Law. Thank you to both of you. Dominic, I'm going to start with you because entertainment's your thing. I just know it as a customer. I love those concerts. I love the craziness, you know, the yelling and the all that. But I know in COVID, you got to do things differently. The problem is, it's a little like the fog of war. How on earth would they ever be able to prove sort of a direct causation if there is this real finger pointing going on?
No, that's exactly right, Ashley. I think Randy was right when he was talking about the previous case in the previous segment on the Russ set. There you have obvious signs of arguable negligence, right? You have an armorer who's only working on her second film. You have crews shooting up cans on the side. All kinds of reports, 16-hour days to save money being put up in hotel rooms an hour away in each direction. Here, you have 70 crew members. Not all of them are speaking out. As I understand it on the reports that I've seen, there's only like four or five that are speaking out. 70 crew members, they were all, as I understand it, required to get vaccinated. They have to show vaccination cards. They were required to be masked. And they were required to quarantine if they showed symptoms. There was testing. If anyone showed symptoms, they were tested. So I think whoever's going to try, if someone is going to try a negligence suit here, they're going to have exactly what you said, Ashley, a causation challenge. Very different from the other example.
I figure as much. I mean, listen, the accusations, Randy Zellin, are really intense. And I've always sort of felt like roadies and bands are kind of, they're one. I mean, they're backstage together. They party together. If you're a roadie, it's a life that you love because you love that music and they love you back. They can't do what they do without you. So to see this dichotomy, really, it kind of breaks my heart, especially as a KISS fan. Let me just say what KISS had to say about this, because they put out a statement. They said, "We're profoundly heartbroken at the loss of Francis. He was a friend and colleague of 20 years. There's no way to replace him. Millions of people have lost someone special to this horrific virus, and we encourage everyone to get vaccinated. Please protect yourself and your loved ones." They said that to Rolling Stone. But some of the roadies were saying, "Are you kidding me? I mean, we've been frustrated for weeks. And by the time Fran died, I thought, you have to be effing kidding me." I mean, they were really angry. But the band says the roadies weren't doing what they were supposed to do either. They said that they weren't always getting the tests that they were supposed to get. They said that they were faking vax cards at times. And Randy, they also said that they would say that their illness or what they were feeling was nothing and ended up being COVID. So they were saying they were faking their illnesses, too. That's got to count for something.
I will return the favor to my old friend Dominic. When we look at our last segment, the Rust case, and we can all spruce up, and I've been practicing my Latin. There's a Latin term called res ipsa loquitur, which means something doesn't happen in the absence of negligence. Like if an airplane engine fell through the roof of my home, there's no way an engine falls off of a plane unless someone is negligent. Someone doesn't die on the set of on a movie set because there's a live bullet in a gun that's a prop without there being negligence. To Dominic's point and to your point, yes, we live in a new age. We live in the age of COVID. We could do everything right. We could socially distance. We can mask up. We can take every precaution, but people will get sick and people will die. So in this particular case, a man died and now people are pointing fingers. It's going to be the evidence. It's very easy after the fact to say what's happening. But through discovery, for example, the lawyers will be able to look at things like, did anyone complain? Not after the fact, but contemporaneously. Are there emails? Are there text messages? Were there meetings? Is there proof that vaccine cards were vetted? Is there proof that people hit? Maybe roadies amongst themselves said, "Hey, listen, I got a cough. I can't taste anything. Don't say anything." In other words, was it kept from the KISS management people and the KISS band? So all of this evidence is going to come out where we will see, are people talking in hindsight? Are they Monday morning quarterbacking? Or did KISS actually turn a blind eye and create a hazardous environment where now we know, tragically, someone died?
Well, you know, all right, so guys, stay with me, if you will. Hold on one second. I'm going to hold that thought because I want to hear it. It has been a tough issue. We're going to have more on this after the break. But before that, there is this PSA, part of it, by Gene Simmons that he put out in March of 2020 during quarantine. I wanted everyone to hear. Take a listen.
I just want you to consider the following During World War II, 50 million people died. Your grandparents were asked to serve. Many of them gave the ultimate sacrifice. You know what's being asked of you? Stay at home, sit on your rump, binge watch Twilight Zone all day long while people risk their lives and bring you food. So let's get over ourselves.
Back now with attorneys Dominic Romano and Randy Zellin. So, Dominic, the KISS crews pulled out of the harbor today, and all I kept thinking was, yikes, with all this COVID business, it's really hard to social distance on a cruise. Do you think there's some exposure for the cruise operator, but also Norwegian, which runs this cruise?
Potentially, yes. But there's also this concept of voluntary assumption of risk, and a legal concept. 70 crew members, according to reports, on that KISS tour right now, after 18 months of being sidelined during the heart of COVID, they're going back out there. They have a choice to go on tour or to stay. And if you're going to sue the band or management for catching COVID or for wrongful death, you're going to have to show that there was a negligent environment or that there was negligence there on the part of the operators of the tour, or even now if something happens on that cruise ship. And, you know, in a cruise ship is a more controlled environment. But, you know, this person that tragically died, Francis Stuber, you know, did he get COVID on set? Did he go out drinking? And according to the report in the Rolling Stone, one of the crew members actually approached him and said, hey, you're looking quite sick. Maybe you should stay in your hotel. Maybe you should get tested. And he, according to that report, refused and said, no, I'll be fine, potentially endangering himself and other people who had, you know, arguably or according to those reports, faked their vaccination card. So I think
this is good, interesting information for everybody who has an event, honestly, like not just the KISS concert, but every single person out there with an event. And I could talk to you guys forever because I love KISS and I love both of you, but I'm flat out of time. Thank you so much, Dominic. Thank you, Randy. Have a great weekend, both of you. And you, thank you for being here. You have a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday.